And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
This is the Hagman and Hagman Report for tonight. I'm not getting any audio, Eric, just so you know. This is the Hagman and Hagman Report for tonight.
Check
welcome.
Your plug.
Welcome to this episode of the Hagman and Hagman Report. Yeah, that threw me right off there, didn't it? There we go. We're doing some upgrades, doing some changing around here at the Hagman and Hagman Studios. And that was my fault, I guess. The plug, it was not in tight. Now it is. Thank you. It's all good, though. It's all good. Folks, we broadcast live each and every weeknight, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. That's Monday through Friday. Thanks for joining us tonight. Thank you for your belief and your trust in us as we walk through this minefield of current events together. And it is a minefield. Folks, don't forget, we've got two different websites, HagmanReport.com. That's the place to go. Bookmark that website. It's HagmanReport.com. And, of course, HagmanandHagman.com for the show information. And you can... follow us on both Facebook and Twitter. Like us on Facebook, Hagman Report. That's Facebook, Hagman Report, and Twitter, at Hagman Report. I've got a personal Facebook and Twitter account as well, should you so desire. Lady or Studio Dog does input more than I do there. And, I was talking to Steve Quayle earlier today, and, he called me up and, we talked for quite a while. A lot of things taking place, a lot of things on his radar, and stuff that we're going to be getting into. He had a number of very good conversations with sources. And, you know, you just don't... I mean, things are going sideways now. So we're going to be talking about Russia and the United States, what's going on with Russia. We're going to be talking about Pakistan and India, the entire geopolitical spectrum. Before we get into the program, just want to mention, folks, that tonight's program brought to you by HelloFresh. You know, HelloFresh is the best meal delivery service, bar none. Now, we are the Hagman household, my wife and I, we use HelloFresh, we're customers. And HelloFresh, they deserve that everyone deserves a natural, delicious, healthy meal. And what they do is they send out each week HelloFresh creates a new delicious recipe with step-by-step instructions designed to take about a half hour to cook for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks who are short on time. They source the freshest ingredients. They measure the exact quantities so there's no food waste. And they also have a full-time registered dietitian on staff who reviews each recipe to make sure that it's nutritionally balanced. HelloFresh is fantastic. It's really saved us time and has given us the way. Oh, there.
Is that Apron from HelloFresh?
Yeah. There I am. And see, we do practice what we preach. There is a meal right there from HelloFresh, and yes,
I see the stove, I see the apron,
yeah, and it's in the box.
I don't
see
box. Anything cooking.
Oh no, my wife, my wife says you can't mess with good food. But folks, look, go to HelloFresh.com. That's HelloFresh.com, and our promo code is Hagman, HAGMANN. That's HelloFresh.com, Hagman. And by the way, listeners of our program get $35 off your first week of deliveries. So visit HelloFresh.com, enter the promo code Hagman, H-A-G-M-A-N-N, when you subscribe. It's really painless, and it's great. It's a fantastic service. That's right. We do this. And I mentioned the other night, I saw our lady, the studio dog, loves it, only because she gets... like, I'll give her a bite. She'll sneak in, you know, I'll give her a bite. And she knows. I swear that she knows that... It's great food. I mean, it's not grocery store food. This is the best. But anyway, I love that. I love HelloFresh. But by the way, we don't, and this is something everyone should know. When we talk about products like this, we don't endorse products that we don't use or we haven't tested and tried. So there you have it. But the news headlines, man.
Well, here's, I want to say this.
Fire away.
What we're going to get into tonight. We're going to be in this segment covering news, current events, headlines, as my dad said, geopolitics from economics, both international and domestic. We're also going to be talking about the escalation in Syria between the U.S. and Russia, as well as what we see happening between India and Pakistan and the military escalation there, as Pakistan is mobilizing its army and launching some drones, and the tensions are rising there. But we're going to do something a little bit different tonight in tonight's show. We want to have listener interaction, and we're doing so through our social media Facebook feed.
Yeah.
The Hagman Report, folks, and the link is under the show description, The Hagman and Hagman Report on Facebook. You can submit a question, and we will answer listener questions throughout the show and keep them clean. Keep them relevant.
Well, of course.
And we will answer it.
Yeah, our listeners, the questions we have already, Joe, are phenomenal questions. I mean, really.
Okay. And I'm looking forward to answering them. And again, folks, there's a link underneath, if you're on YouTube listening, or on Blog Talk in the show description, there's a link right to our Facebook page, The Hagman and Hagman Report, and you can post the question right under the post where it asks for the questions. And we will answer those as the show goes on. Now, in the second segment, second segment, we are going to have Lane Miller of Minuteman Rocket Stove join us. He's going to come on and talk about a little bit about his Minuteman Rocket Stove, but also about
how to start fires.
How to start fires and how to do so efficiently. And it's something that he says that, you know, we talk a lot about and we don't really practice. So he wants to go over some basics with fire starting.
You know, I had and this is true, I had a situation with attempting to start a good fire, and I've got a fireplace, okay, but when you try to start fires, especially in adverse conditions, there are a few things to, once I heard what Lane Miller has to say, once I heard about this, about how to properly start fire. And you think, well, that's common sense. Well, 90% of it is. That 10% is what Lane Miller is going to give us tonight. So the 10% is to help you, that's right, start fires that will last and burn and cook your meals. And we, who knows, man, we might be, hey, some people on the East Coast, with respect to the weather, the hurricanes, you don't know if you're going to have power and gas service up there. You know, with the inclement weather facing, and it's been 4,000 days since the United States has had any significant hurricane.
And with Hurricane Matthew, while you mentioned hurricane, there is a hurricane down in the Caribbean, Hurricane Matthew.
Yep.
And it's considered a major hurricane. It's been bumped up to a Category 4, and the track for the hurricane looks as though it could go through the Caribbean up north, and from that point north, it could veer off into the Atlantic Ocean, or it could hug the U.S. East Coast. And I don't know how, but some are even predicting that it could pull a Sandy type move and go inland, anywhere between the Carolinas up through New Hampshire. So that's something that we're going to have to keep our eye on. Hurricane Matthew will threaten the central and northern Caribbean region with flooding, rain, damaging winds, and big storm surge early next week. Matthew is currently a Category 4 and will continue to move west-southwestward across the central Caribbean Sea before making an abrupt turn to the north this weekend. Matthew's the second major hurricane of the season, following Gadsden from August. Now, it goes on to say that the mostly the Caribbean is what is in the crosshairs right now. But the question for America is, what will happen with Matthew after it moves north and away from the Caribbean? And will we see it make landfall here in the United States? So something to keep your eye on there as far as weather is concerned.
And isn't it interesting, the timing? I find the timing a little bit interesting. You know, I don't know. The end of September, beginning of October. Of course, this is hurricane season.
It's been hurricane season since June, I believe.
Well, right, June through December, basically, is the time. But yeah, it is indeed something to keep your eyes open about. Now, one thing I want to just bring up here, because there's a lot of talk right now. The United States ceding the control of the internet. And I'm seeing a lot of hysteria associated with this. I do believe, just based on my research, that yes, you're gonna be able to eventually, there will eventually be ramifications from this. I don't believe that there will be. I've seen postings where people are saying, "Well, if I don't see you on the internet, you know, I mean, if this is the last day, I'll talk."
Right.
To you.
People think it's going to be some instantaneous type thing. Where, you know, the internet's turned over at midnight tonight, and tomorrow it's going to look like a whole new and different landscape, unrecognizable to what it is today. No, not at all.
No.
And you posted a story today on the Hagmann Report about four states suing to block Obama's internet transition set for the, which would be tonight.
Midnight,
it was from Zero Hedge, I believe, Tyler Durden.
Yeah.
And this gets into, you know, the who's fighting against it, Ted Cruz being one of the opponents, setting up, trying not to let them hand over the control of the internet. And you know, I guess what is going to happen,
well,
as this is turned over under Obama, a plan that is, from my understanding, you know, Obama's unconstitutionally and illegally handing something over. He does not have the authority to do so without the approval
the
of Congress.
That's right. Exactly. And everyone's familiar, or probably everyone listening to this is familiar with the URLs, the address bar. When you look on the address bar, you
www.
see, right,
you, and then that's the URL.
But aside from the alphabetical name, there is a numeric address associated with that website. And in fact, I think Steve Quayle has posted his on his front page. The actual numeric address will not be affected. The names could very well be affected. With this ceding the control over ICANN, the ICAA or ICANN. However, this is going to be incremental in nature and is more economic. It's going to have more of an economic impact and a gradual incremental censorship impact, as opposed to, well, good night, everyone. You know, lights out, bang. That's not going to happen. Or at least I don't believe it will. Of course, I could be wrong, but I don't think that'll be the case. So, you know, let's back off the hysteria on this, and let's understand the ramifications. And there's some stories, articles out there, and we don't have to go through it, but you can find the results that potential results on the internet transfer.
And it's something we're definitely going to continue to keep our eye on. Now, the presidential debates, they were covered here on the Hagmann and Hagmann Report. I was absent the day the debate happened. I was literally in just a fever pitch in my bed, just in misery. But you mentioned something about the debates the other day that has turned out to be pretty accurate. This, according to the Daily Caller, the Presidential Debate Commission admits Trump's mic was messed up. The Commission on Presidential Debates reported on Friday that there were, in fact, issues with Donald Trump's microphone at the debate Monday evening. Following the debate, Trump told the press that they gave me a defective mic. Did you notice that?
Well,
my mic was defective.
It wasn't
within the room.
No. See, this is not. Maybe that's what Trump said. But
yeah,
what they did was they lowered the volume on the mic. So you've got Clinton being able to talk here and look out and look at the camera, and you had Trump having to talk right into the mic because the volume on the mic was adjusted low.
And Trump did pose the question, was this on purpose?
Absolutely it was on purpose. Don't tell me you've got 100 million people watching and you're going to have something screw up like this. No, I don't think so. The lighting was, and you're going to hopefully see stories about the lighting, because these are Hollywood stage tricks that were employed against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care.
And Hillary Clinton also had help that went beyond even receiving the debate questions early and being shielded from controversial subjects from the debate moderator.
Of course.
There were different things with the podium that people noticed, from people handing and taking away talking points or papers. There was the question of another earpiece being worn during the debate for the potential of being fed information through an earpiece. And we see what happened. You know, it has now come out that they say Trump had issues and there were sound level problems. But as you said, it was something that seemed to be on purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe it was. Now, the you know, it was not really a debate. When you have a moderator that asks candidate A one question and candidate B another question, that's merely two simultaneous press conferences. That's not a debate. A debate is the same question answered by both parties mm-hmm. all of the time. Just look at the 1960 debate between Kennedy and Nixon. And it's online, folks. You can see this online. To me, that's a gold standard in terms of debating. Only because that was the first televised debate of any presidential election in history. It's my understanding. But there were things that I don't know if I should say employed there. You had Nixon that was pasty, sweaty, and his appearance was not as put together as Kennedy's. Okay, the lighting might have been somewhat off as well, but maybe that's as far as it went. But the moderation of that debate was a lot different than as it is today. And there's another thing I noticed too. There was an element of statesmanlike conduct between both individuals. There was no shoulder shimmy. Yeah. Shoulder shimmy. Did y'all catch Hillary's shoulder shimmy? What are we, in 12th grade? Seriously?
What's a shoulder shimmy?
Oh, I'm not going to do it.
Was it like a...
I'm not going to do it. I mean, I looked at that and I thought, you know, 10th grade behavior. And it blew my mind that you have adults playing that over and over again and celebrating that behavior.
So this is a song. Hillary Clinton's shimmy song is the election. Yeah.
No, they put it to music. It's just a show.
Oh, okay. I see
her shoulder movements. To me, come on, really, you got to do that. This is how. They're laughing at you. They're laughing at us. These people are laughing at us. They think that the entirety of the American public is stupid. And many people are. I'm sorry. Because you can't fix stupid. You can't rehabilitate stupid. Well, you can fix stupid. It's gonna, however, it would take a lot of
work. They count on the people not to do the research, the due diligence to find out the truth. You know, there's an interesting article that came out today about the percentage of people that trust the fact checking of the presidential nominees, and it was, I believe, 29%.
By the way, it's not a moderator's job to fact check. You don't fact check as a moderator. You leave the comment stand. You don't correct the participants, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and the 29%, it was. They say the public trusted the voters don't trust media fact checking from a Rasmussen poll. And as you said, we've seen this so often in this election cycle. But they go on to say most voters believe news organizations play favorites when it comes to fact checking candidate statements. But this skepticism is much stronger among voters who support Donald Trump than those who back rival Hillary Clinton. And that would be obvious as to the reason why, is because we see Hillary is, as we say, protected, is allowed to lie with immunity, not only to the American public through the media, but to Congress, to the Senate, and to the FBI, and gets in no trouble, no perjury, nothing. But this Rasmussen report did a national online survey, found that just 29% of all likely voters trust media fact-checking of candidates' comments. 62% believe instead that news organizations skew the facts to help candidates they support. And I would agree 100% with that. They do skew the facts to help candidates they support. And if you've been paying attention and had your eyes opened this election cycle, you will see that basically Hillary Clinton is getting away with murder, basically, literally, with Benghazi, with her email scandal and those who came out against her, from Seth Rich to other... just look at the Hillary body count, the Hillary death body count, the Clinton body count, starting with Bill Clinton, moving to Hillary Clinton.
You can go all the way back to Johnson, for that matter.
Absolutely. And to see the media, and what you said about how the media and the powers that be view the public as stupid, they go so far as to, I mean, just look at Benghazi. They have proof that Hillary Clinton knew it was not a YouTube video that started some spontaneous, you know, rebellion that led to what happened in Benghazi. They knew from the very exact moment, probably from beforehand, that it was a terror attack.
Yes.
It's already come out through their communications. Hillary Clinton communicated to her daughter, Chelsea Clinton, that it was an Al-Qaeda coordinated attack that killed Ambassador Chris
Stevens. Just so you know, Chelsea Clinton was using a pseudonym as well.
Mm-hmm. And they, for days after, came out and blamed some obscure YouTube anti-Islam video. And this is not being brought up when the questions are being asked to Hillary Clinton about Benghazi. Are they being asked? No. They're not asking her about, you know, her lying about being under sniper fire when landing in Bosnia. They're not asking her about her lying about her health records, about her email records, and what the FBI said. They're not holding her accountable to her lies about Benghazi and her money that she funneled through the Clinton Foundation, helping foreign governments and pay-to-play schemes like Saudi Arabia and whatnot. And just so folks understand, you know, Obama and Hillary Clinton, they were paid by Saudi Arabia to veto that bill that allowed 9/11 families to sue Saudi Arabia pertaining to their involvement in 9/11. And because the Senate vetoed Obama's veto, they're going to find another way around, you know, how to get out of that. But this is what they pay their money for. This is what they pay for influence. They pay for favors. And they pay for appointments, meaning as Hillary Clinton is put in the Department of State, other positions open up, people donate to the Clinton Foundation, and, you know, it's even in the WikiLeaks reports and document dumps. Some of the people who, you know, donated big bucks ended up getting top-tier positions in places in government. And it's no coincidence that just because they donated, they got the positions, it's directly the direct result of their money given to the Clinton Foundation that gave them those positions, just like the debate moderators. All of the debate moderators donated only to Hillary Clinton. Why do you think they were picked to moderate these debates? It is a rigged system, and we are only being shown what they want us to see. And some call this desperation, but Salon ran this piece today, and I guess we can end our presidential election discussion with this. Hate unleashed. How Donald Trump unleashed the right-wing bigots that the GOP once kept under control. Now, this was released today, and this goes on to say, there have been a lot of talk over this campaign over the lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton compared with the excitement and energy among Donald Trump's followers. It's a bit overblown. There are plenty of highly enthusiastic Clinton fans who are very excited to see the first woman president.
And stop there, because that seems to be just like the first black president, which is not a true statement. You've got Hillary is the first woman.
Paid Hollywood actors president. Don't count. You know. Yeah, paid Hollywood actors don't count. Award shows, you know, the 10 people that show up to her rallies at colleges, those people don't count. Anyway, they go on to say, but it is nonsense, or nonetheless true, that Trump has inspired a group of remarkably passionate, committed followers. And while many of these people have legitimate economic gripes that are finding expression in Trump's angry outsider populism, What electrifies many of them is something else entirely. They chant, build that wall, lock her up. They cheer wildly when Trump says he will ban Muslims and send refugees back where they came from. They catcall the media and show how protesters, are hit while Trump cheers them on from the stage, saying that Trump is endorsing violence against protesters at his rallies. Anyway, what they're doing is turning everything around from the way it really is. And they even go on to say, you know, that Trump's selling T-shirts that say misogynistic things towards Hillary Clinton's and have Confederate flags at his rallies and basically aligns himself with white supremacy groups and the alt-right. But again, these are, is this desperation or is this just more of the propaganda trying to get people to hate Donald Trump?
You know where it's coming from? No, it's coming from RevCom.com. Don't go there, folks. RevCom.com. We're going to talk about that after the break, but that's where it's coming from.
USA Today, I think for the first time in its history, threw its hat in on a presidential nominee.
Saying Trump is unfit
to be president.
Yep. The USA, for the first time in its miserable life, did that. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman Report. On the other side, we're going to be taking, Lane Miller, going to give you some instructions on the proper way to start a fire. Okay. This is in our collegiate prep series. Okay. That's, this is important stuff. And then, of course, we're going to be talking about addressing your Facebook questions, your questions on Facebook. You can still get them in. Go to Facebook, Hagman Report. Like us on Facebook as well. We're going to be right back. Stay right where you're at. This is the Hagman and Hagman Report back at you. Another segment, HagmanReport.com. That's our website, HagmanReport.com. The show can be heard, seen, viewed, accessed at HagmanandHagman.com. You can, we're also on social networking. We asked, we had a conversation. We had a situation. I had a situation not too long ago trying to, deal with fire. Okay. I was thinking about this and I attempted to recreate a condition where without power, without gas, without any type of accelerant, how to create a fire. And I was having difficulty and I'm thinking, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only person that has difficulty in this aspect. All right. So we asked Lane Miller to come on and talk about that. It's given the fact that, that his product, the Minuteman Rocket Stove, relies on fire, of course. And he's got fire starters. So that was the guy that we asked to explain this. So we have Lane Miller on from MinutemanStove.com to talk about the art of the proper way to start a fire, either for heat or for cooking, from our College of Knowledge section of the Hagman Report, giving you information, of course, that'll help you survive in those times when you find yourself under the not the best of conditions. So, Mr. Lane Miller from MinutemanStove.com, thanks for coming on. Let's talk.
Hey, Doug. Hey, Joe. How are you guys doing tonight? Thank you. Thank you very much for having me back on the show.
Yeah, no great problem. To have you. And we are doing fantastic. And I know you're fresh off of a number of trade shows that you were involved in, and it's great to have you back on.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the last one I went to was in Saluda, North Carolina, about 2 weeks ago. It was Prepper Camp. It was a lot of fun. It was a three-day outing, and everybody camped out, and it was a lot of fun. The weather was nice all the way until the very end. We got rained out in the last hour of the show, which was not bad. But it was a really good time, and actually got to do a lot of what we're going to be talking about tonight, fire making. So it's kind of fresh off of me doing some of it, and that's good because it's fresh. fresh in my mind. But
am I the only guy in the world that sometimes has trouble starting a good fire? I mean, seriously.
No, I still have trouble starting a good fire. It's sometimes it's really
difficult.
Well, then
difficult. What are we doing asking you then?
Well, I mean, I can get it done usually. I do have some tricks, but, you know, it can be very difficult. And the thing that makes it the hardest is if you're in wet conditions. That is always a chore. You just have to know the tricks and be able to implement these techniques. And usually you can achieve what you're trying to do, even in the worst of conditions. But, you know, it's always it's one of the most basic survival skills for all of us to know. And just being at prep camp, I watched a few people kind of struggle and was like, oh, you know, you could use a little remedial in this. But of course I didn't say anything to them, but you know, it's something that we all need to really make sure that we can do and that we can do in bad conditions, you know, to be fully prepared. You know, it's the most basic thing. You know, when we learned how to conquer fire early on, you know, that really took us up a notch. And it's very, very important, because as humans, our bodies just don't do cold very well, and we don't do wet very well, not like animals do. So we really need that fire. And, you know, tonight I just want to go over some of the basics. It's such an in-depth subject. You could go on and on. I could spend the whole 3 hours on this, but I'll just gloss over some things. And basically, if the people listening tonight, just take a few notes on the things that are important and go look them up. This is a very visual topic, so some of these things you'll, you know, maybe not be able to picture in your mind's eye, but there's all kinds of videos on YouTube that show the techniques we'll talk about, the things we're going to talk about. And, you know, I would say just take some quick notes as we talk and then go do your homework. And then you got all weekend to practice, because it's Friday okay. night, so you got Saturday and Sunday.
Right. And here's what I'd like, Lane. I would like you to, in your mind, pretend mm-hmm. you were talking with my wife or my adult daughter, okay?
Okay.
Or someone that maybe either has an impairment or is not, you know, the underdog, shall we say, whether actual
right,
or,
right.
You know what I'm saying? So, only because, look, there are so many people who are alone out there and so many people who are, you know, so yeah, they gear that towards the people and the people like me who can't do, you know.
well, we'll just go through the basics. I mean, I'm not going to talk about friction techniques like bow and drill and hand spindle. I mean, those are very difficult and, you know, should be avoided if at all possible. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of knowledge to pull that off. And it's even impossible for an expert in bad conditions to get that going. So we're going to go with the things and talk about, you know, the items that you should have in a kit to make this chore easier. And we're going to talk about, you know, just those kinds of things. And I guess the first place we should start off is what do you start a fire with? And there's a lot of different ways to do it. But, you know, of course, the basic is matches and lighters. And you should always carry those. And as part of your preps, I suggest everybody go down to Sam's Club and buy a 50 sled of lighters and put them in a closet and forget you have them. You know, they're going to be something you'll never be able to buy again, you know, possibly. And a great barter item as well. And it'll always be something you can have a good supply on. They're not that expensive. Just buy them in bulk and put them away. But matches and lighters are, of course, you know, the go-to in the modern day. They do have some very big drawbacks, though. They're both extremely susceptible to moisture. Matches, even the waterproof kind, over time, as they're exposed to the weather, they're gonna fail on you and be useless. Lighters, also the same. The little ferro that's in a lighter will corrode and deteriorate very fast, and the little wheels get all jammed up, and you know, moisture is really hard on them too. And it doesn't even take rain. This could just be dew in the morning. So I don't think you should ever rely on those two, but you should always have them just for convenience. The next thing I would always have, now this is my favorite way to start a fire, is with what's called a ferrocerium rod. And of course we do manufacture these, and we have them available at Minuteman Provision Company at MinutemanStove.com, so you can go there and look at them. And you know, they're a wonderful way to start a fire. And basically what a ferro rod is it's ferrocerium is the full name of it, and ferro being iron oxide, and that's rust, and they're comprised of rust. and that's mixed with the element cerium, which is a metallic element. And basically, you take a tool steel piece of metal that's attached to our rods. It's a little thing, and you slough it down the side of the rod using the sharp edge of that tool steel, and it takes a little bit of the material off. At the same time, it's providing friction heat using the cerium, and what flies off as sparks is actually burning iron, and it's burning at 3,500 degrees, so it's extremely hot. But it won't hurt your hands. It doesn't stay hot long enough to do that, but it will catch things on fire. So that's my favorite. I love ferro rods. They're very durable. The ones we sell have anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000 strikes in them. So I can tell you from doing trade shows that even our smallest rod, of using them at trade shows to do demonstrations, it'll take me 6 and 8 months of solid trade shows to wear even one of our little ones out. And I've made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fires using one of those. So they are very durable. They're impervious to water. So basically, you just wipe the drops off and start scratching away, and they'll make sparks even when you're wet. So that's a very important aspect of them. They're my favorite. Another thing I carry in my kit is a magnifying glass. So if you're in sunny conditions and you can start a fire with a magnifying glass, just like we used to burn ants back in the day. And that's a great thing to have in your kit as well. There's a bunch of other things. I mean, you can use steel wool and 9-volt battery, and there's a thing called a fire piston and all those other types of things. But, you know, they're kind of fringe. I've never used on, you know, either of those, really. I've seen it done, but I've never carried that in my kit. But, of course, like I said, this is just a gloss over. The things I do carry, though, are the matches and lighters, and I do carry ferro rods, so plenty of those, and I have magnifying glass. And the reason I carry plenty of ferro rods isn't so much that they wear out, it's just having backups for your backups. Always have one that you can lose or two you can lose and you still have one. So that's basically the rundown on fire starters. You know, I guess the next thing to talk about is what do you light on fire with them? And basically it comes down to there's two things, and these I'll get into a little nomenclature now. Tinder and kindling. Now, a lot of people use those words interchangeably, but they really have different meanings. Tinder is typically the very small and very flammable in nature. It'll ignite from a spark. That's the definition of tinder. So the things that I use as tinder and the ones that are easiest to carry in your kit, one is cotton balls and Vaseline. It's such an easy combination. You just take a cotton ball, swipe it through some Vaseline, stuff it down in a pill bottle, and just keep doing that, cramming them down in there until you can't get any more in your pill bottle. And you'll have enough cotton ball and Vaseline mixture in there to make dozens, if not hundreds, of fires just out of one pill bottle. Because you don't have to use a lot of your tinder. It's just to catch the spark and just to get it started.
And that's some really handy, Lane, that you mm-hmm. taught me, actually, when we were first talking with you about your Minuteman stove, is the cotton right. balls and Vaseline. And, you yeah. know, you can take old spaghetti jars or, you know, something smaller like a jam jar, old little mason jars, and mm-hmm. if you get a bag of cotton balls and a thing of Vaseline, and you dip each cotton ball in Vaseline, as Lane said, and stuff them in there and put them in your to-go bag, your bug-out bag, as you said, hundreds of fires can be started with just those, and it's a very simple, easy, and efficient way to do that.
Yeah, and if you don't want to go buy cotton balls, you can even use the dryer one out of your dryer. You know, as long as it's not full of polyester, the dryer lint in your dryer is basically just fibrous cotton, so it's an excellent fire tinder as well. There's another one that's called charred cloth that you can make. That's kind of an old school way, but basically you just take t-shirt material, 100% cotton t-shirt material, and I make it in aluminum foil. I cut it into about 2 or 3 inch squares, and I'll stack it in aluminum foil, and then you just throw it in a fire, you know, for a little bit. Now make sure your aluminum foil sealed up good and tight. You don't want any air getting inside, but you can also do this inside of like a little steel bottle or something like that. As long as the air can't get to it and it can't ignite, it'll heat up in there and just turn black. And you know it's done when your material is turned totally black. then you pull that out, and that charred cloth, if you hit it with a spark, it will actually start burning and catch that ember and give you enough that you can get your fire started. That's very good. Finally, shredded paper can work as long as the paper is really dry and it's shredded up very well. But one of my absolute favorites is called fatwood. It's found in the stumps and in the knots of dead pine trees. And the reason I like it so much is that it's laying around in the woods. And here's where, folks, you can just, write this down, fatwood and how to harvest, and go look it up on a YouTube video. There's dozens of these videos that will show you how to harvest fatwood. Now, we sell a variety of fatwood at Minuteman Stove. We call it Maya sticks. It's actually imported up from Honduras, and it's got an extremely high resin content, as high as 80%. So this stuff is just chock full of resin, and that's what fatwood is. The pine tree dies, but the roots continue to pump the sap up into the tree, and it just coalesces in the stump and in the knots, and that resin is extremely volatile. And to use a piece of fat wood to make a fire, basically what you do is create what's called Maya dust. And our sticks come, they're about 8 inches long and about 3/8 inch square. But you just basically take your pocket knife or any knife, and you slough the side of it with the edge of the knife, and it'll scrape down, and you scrape down, and you scrape down, and it'll make a pile of this real fuzzy-looking type of, like we call it, Maya dust. It's fuzzy, and it's extremely good. You just need a little pile of it. I mean, as big around as a quarter, really. That's all you need. And you hit that with your ferro rod, and it'll light right up, and that resin burns very hot, and it burns very long. And fatwood can also be shaved into shavings, which would make it more kindling, but it can be shaved into shavings, and it's extremely hot when it burns, and it burns a good long time. So that's something I wish anybody who lives near pine trees learn about fatwood and how to harvest it. It's excellent. But if you want some of the premium, we certainly have it at our site, the best fatwood I've ever used. It's fantastic. Cedar bark can be used as well. It doesn't have resin in it so much, but you can take that fuzz and kind of roll it up in a ball and hit that with some sparks, and it'll catch on fire. Even the fuzz from cattails and dandelion flowers, those little fuzzy balls at the end of the dandelion flowers, that stuff will catch on fire as well from sparks. So it's excellent tinder too. And depending on your geographic area, there's all kinds of local things that grow in the wild that you can use, and there's all kinds of homemade things you can use too. But always know that you can use the lint out of your pockets. You can take a piece of t-shirt material and bang it with a rock until it's fuzzed up to the point where it'll catch a spark. So cotton is always a great one, and most times, even if you didn't bring any with you, you'll be able to harvest it out of your clothing. So always remember that trick. And the Vaseline doesn't make it catch on fire any easier. It just makes it burn longer. So if you don't have Vaseline, the cotton ball will still work. You just don't have as much time to work with it to get your kindling going. But basically, that's the... Go ahead.
I got a question about the size of fires. Now, say you're outdoors and you're having to shelter in place, per se, and building yourself a shelter for the evening. When you build a fire, especially if you're in a colder environment, you want it to keep you warm for as long as possible. What would be a good, some people start, you build the fire with a little bit of tinder and then you throw some smaller wood on top. And then, but you see some of the people who build, big fires where they have, maybe a 3 to 5 foot radius, and they put the sticks up in a vertical type position against each other.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what's the best way to build a longer lasting fire that can keep you sustained, through most of an evening without having to continue to throw wood on it?
Well, there is a type of fire that's known as the all-night fire, believe it or not. You build a structure that's in kind of a V shape. You take some sticks and you stick them into the ground in a V shape, and you stack your logs which you'll, you know, cut. Say you've got 4 to 5 inch diameter logs, you'll line them up one side and line them up the other side of the V, and you build the fire in the middle. And as the fire burns all night, those logs will actually roll one after another as it burns down into the fire, believe it or not. And you can start the fire in the evening, and it'll still be going in the morning. They'll burn all night long. So that's one technique. You can look at that, look that one up. It's called the overnight fire. There's another technique that I saw that that the Russians used out in the woods, and it's a three log fire. And basically, you build your fire between two really big logs, and you build a fire in between them with the gap being, let's call it, a foot, and the logs are 4 or 5 feet long. And then right before you go to bed, you put a third large log on top of those two logs that are down below. And because of the way that the fire wraps around the log, it just radiates off of it. And you sleep one person to either side of that fire. And that's a really good fire for keeping you warm at night. Now, I don't know if that'll last all night, but, you know, that's a technique that I saw that the Russians use, and I thought that was pretty cool. I never had a chance to try that one, though, even though I do know the overnight fire does work very well. That was developed by pioneers going across the plains. They use that type of fire, the all-night fires. So that's one thing. Now, one thing that we probably want to talk about is how to start your fire. And the most important thing about starting a fire is to pre-plan the whole process that you're going to use out and have everything prepped ahead of time. This is one of the first mistakes people make. You need to have a little pile in front of you that you're tender and what's known as a bird's nest. Now, anybody who doesn't know what a bird's nest is, it looks just like a bird's nest. You go and you gather little small tinder and grasses, and you build a little cup shape, and you put your tinder in the middle of that, and you strike your fire, and then as your tinder starts to burn, you kind of wrap the edges of the bird's nest around, and it'll catch, you know, the whole bundle on fire. And then that's the bundle that you stick into your pre-made, ready-to-go little structure. Say it's a little, you know, teepee-style structure of sticks. You stick that whole thing in there, and that's how I typically get my fire started. And it's, you know, also the way, it's the best way, especially if you're doing something from embers where you don't actually have a fire to begin with. You'd use that bird's nest because you blow over the embers, and it'll light the bird's nest on fire. And I'm talking about techniques like the charred cloth or using a fire piston, or if you did happen to have to use a bow and drill or, you know, a hand spindle of some type like that to start your fire, you'll want to create a bird's nest. But have all this stuff pre-planned out in little piles, you know, gradually getting larger and larger up until you get to your main fuel. You know, your main logs are here ready. But pre-plan everything and have it all right in front of you so you don't find yourself having to sit there and snap wood real quick or go find some more while you're trying to start your fire. It's during those times when you're not paying attention is when your fire will go out or, you know, start to fail on you. So definitely do that. You know, when you do start your fire, make sure to do it in a safe place, of course, and clear everything away that's combustible so you don't start a forest fire. You can even make a ring of rocks and that kind of stuff around it. And you always want to start with smaller sticks and build your fire with smaller sticks. One of the main mistakes that I see people make is they try to put big wood on too early. And yeah, you really need to get your fire going and get a good, you know, base of little coals and get it good and hot, kind of dry that area out a little bit where you're making your fire before you keep adding big wood to it. Just remember that every piece of wood that you add to your fire subtracts away heat and energy to heat that piece of wood up until it initially combusts and starts adding back to your fire. So it's kind of taking the energy out until it starts giving some back. So that's why you want to keep it small and don't overfeed your fire in the beginning, because it'll just suck the life right out of it.
And you said something important, too, about making sure, you know, brush and things are cleared away. As we've seen numerous humongous forest fires started from people not being careful, not only from you know, not taking care of the areas around their fire, but for thinking they're out just because they don't see actual fire coming out of where they had the fire. Instead, you know, you have the burning charcoal that's just sitting under layers of ash that, unless it's put out, for the most part, still continues to burn, which can cause, you know, massive problems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, put it out with water if you can, you know, if that's available to you in quantity. Put it out with water and make sure you can, if you can't, you need to bury everything, or at least, you know, if you can't put your hand through everything that was your fire before and not find a hot spot, then you're not ready to leave yet. Absolutely. And especially if you live out west where there's real dry conditions or something like that, you know, you really need to be careful because, you know, forest fires are bad.
That thing, Smokey Bear will be mad at you. So, well, Lane, in the few minutes we have left, I just want to drive home the point. Your rocket stove is going to be a lifesaver, and I mean this sincerely.
Oh, thank you.
The fact that we have and others have the long term storable food.
Right.
We need a method to cook the food. And I think yours, now we've tried, in the prep business, we've tried other items, but yours is by far the greatest that we've found. And this is why we have, you know, we're so glad that you're partnered up with us in terms of getting this product to people. Having said
thank you,
we only have about 2 minutes left. So, okay. Tell people about your stove and how to get that and what they'll get and so on.
Well, you can go to our website. It's MinutemanStove.com. MinutemanStove.com. It's a really nice website. You can go there, and we've got our fire starters. Now we've added some cast iron cookware. I spoke about that last time I was on, and we'd always sold it at shows, but we've added some packages there of that, and really enhanced our site. If you hadn't been there in a while, we're going to be adding even more items next week. So everybody, please come. And the stove is a great thing to have. I mean, you really need a way to cook. And if you don't have access to a big stand of woods where you can, you know, make big, huge open fires, this is absolutely the most economical way from a fuel standpoint to cook that there is. I mean, you'll use less than a tenth, probably around a twentieth of the fuel that you'd use in an open fire. They don't make a lot of smoke. You're not putting up a big smoke column. It's portable, and it seals up airtight, so you can keep it in your vehicle. No smell, no soot. It's an excellent item. You know, I designed it just for us, just for this need, for the prepper. And, you know, I built the first one just for myself, and everybody I showed it to thought it was great. So that's why we're even doing this. So we really hope you'll do it. And I tell you, we've had a lot of business come from the Hagman Show. It's been awesome. We really appreciate all the orders that we've gotten, and we hope everybody's happy with their shove. And Fire Strikers as well, we've got them. Ours are the sparkiest I could find. It's the best fire rods I can find, and they make a huge spark, and they're very durable. So we hope you guys will come and take a look at those as well.
Yeah, your fire starters are great, as well as your rocket stoves. And for those watching on YouTube here, I got actually one of the fire starters right here. It is just a wooden handle with the fire starter rod coming out of it, and you have a little metal striker, which you can strike,
right,
and you can get the sparks going. Real simple and easy. My dad doesn't like me. Yeah, he doesn't like me to do it in the studio. Lane, I want to thank you for
understand that.
I want to thank you for joining us on this show, and it's been very educational. We were talking about how to build fires properly and efficiently. And folks, visit Lane's site, Minuteman Stove, and purchase a Minuteman rocket stove if you have not already, because it can be a lifesaver without any electricity and or means to cook your food. Lane, thank you so much. You have a great weekend.
Thank you, guys. And yeah.
Take care. All right, folks, we'll be right back with your questions and news on the other side of this break. Stay with us.